All right. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Okay, y'all are woke. Okay, that's a good thing. My name is Karen Hutt, and this is Jane Maldin. And Maldin, I'm sorry. We just met. We've been, and I also embraced all of what is New Orleans last night and got back at 4:30 this morning. And I'm 59, so there. The 30-year-olds could not make it. All right, we're going to get started on this workshop called Radical Chaplaincy. I want to start by telling you a little brief story about how even this workshop came to be sponsored by Skinner Books. About 3, maybe even 4 years ago now, I had an urge, because chaplaincy where I was at the time was to meet other UU chaplains, and I didn't know any, hardly at all. And I was very disturbed by that, and so I started to search for them on the internet like everybody else, and I went to our UU minister's website to see if I could just click for those who are chaplains, and I could not, because we fall into a category called community ministry, which could be a variety of things, whether it be running a nonprofit, etc. So poking around, I started to figure out who was what and where they were, and I started to create a list, and they were some amazing, amazing people, and Jane was one of those people that I met online, and I had the thought that maybe we should have a book with of the experiences of UU chaplains. We don't even have an organization like other denominations do. Lutherans have a UU, a chaplain group, the Presbyterians, but we don't have an organization within our august bodies to go to when we need one another or to share our work with you. So a book was produced, and this is a shameful self-promotion right now. It's in the Skinner bookstore called The Call to Care. It's 16 essays by Unitarian Universalist chaplains, from prison to military to rehab to hospital, hospice, all kinds of folks, places where we are usually working quietly in isolation from one another.
Karen, they're available in the UUA bookstore downstairs. They're in the center table. Stacks of them waiting.
That's I got one.
All right, great. Absolutely. Well, that was sort of the genesis of how that book came together and why we're having this workshop today. I want to start off also by saying that I'm really honored to be here. I haven't done a workshop in GA in many, many years. I'm a UU minister for about 25 years, and it's exciting to be in this incarnation in my life as a chaplain before you. I also want to point out that this book is probably one of the few books written by African-American UUs that's not about race. So it's actually maybe one of the few, particularly by Skinner. So I just think that's an extra important point to make, is that while we're having all this discussion about race all the time here, there are many other places where African-Americans in our organization, our denomination, are flourishing and growing and contributing that aren't just about, you know, the usual topics. So here we go. The word radical means to affect the fundamental nature of something. It means to get to the root of something and to even perhaps change views, change habits, and perhaps change conditions. To experience what is considered to be radical requires a thorough examination of what is and what could be through the use of curious imagination. Now, we all have experienced, every single one of us, radical shifts in our lives as we discover a new possibility, engage a new belief or thought. Radical shifts occur when we examine these long-held beliefs and maybe find out that they're not serving us so well. Or we have radical shifts in our life when the ground beneath us begins to shake and where we have stood firmly for so long is all of a sudden cracked, and we may have fallen through a hole that seems like we can't get out of. It is here, at the intersection of beliefs and events, that we find the work of the chaplain often, who's often at the edge of that hole that we may be in with a caring eye and a hand to hold. Chaplains show up. Chaplains show up. They show up in the middle of a story with very little information. Someone called or gave them a name or a room number or a cell number or a situation to attend to. Or it could be on a street corner. Chaplains show up. Chaplains show up with their bodies extended in a posture of caring. Hands open, eyes focused, and feet planted with mindful curiosity. They show up without an agenda to be present at the situation, at the here and now of what is happening at this moment. They show up also with a curious kind of flexibility in the form of a humanity that mutates often as needed as they engage the power of an individual's story and their context at that moment. They are not the social worker. They are not coming to fix anything. They are not the doctor coming to cure anything. They are not the prison guard moving people around. They are coming to do the radical act of being available for another human being who is not a friend or a family member, but a stranger. I have shown up as a chaplain at the protest on I-94 in St. Paul. I showed up there and I was part of the conversation between Christians and anarchists who were figuring out how they were going to go at each other. I showed up in the middle of this knowing none of them. The chaplain shows up with a non-anxious radical presence to be able to extend that hand. I show up at the police line to bear witness. I have shown up as a chaplain at the door of the trauma bay in Chicago, in a pediatric level 1 trauma center, where kids came in every day shot up from other kids. I showed up when the mother said to me, "Chaplain, I think my son got shot because I haven't been in church lately." I show up, not with an agenda, not with a purpose to change, but I show up. I show up also in prison. I worked on death row in Illinois, and I worked on death row in Illinois the year that you know, all of the governors in Illinois go to jail, but before this guy went to jail. Blagojevich, Thompson, Ryan. Okay, but Ryan, Governor Ryan, who I actually think got a bum rap, but Governor Ryan, before he went to jail, he ended the death penalty along with many people in the legislature in Illinois. And we were very grateful for that. But I started working on death row, and then I had to end working on death row because they weren't on death row anymore. So I went with some of those guys to the next prison they went to in the general population. And the question there was, how do I, chaplain, prepare to live what I've been preparing to die for 20 years? I showed up. I showed up at their complaints about being off of death row, because death row, you could take a shower every day. You couldn't. Prison, general population, they had better food. So I'm talking to a bunch of guys that aren't going to die who are mad. But I had to show up. I've shown up many times in many places. Robert Dykstra, anybody know who he is? He wrote a great book called Images of Pastoral Care. It's a wonderful book, pretty common book for many seminarians, but I recommend it for lay people as well. He describes being at a conference with psychologists and social workers and others in the helping fields. And when he described his work as a chaplain, a colleague said to him incredulously, "You all are like vultures. You borrow a little of the psychology, a little social work, a little anthropology, a little counseling. You just borrow from any discipline you want when it suits you." Now, at first, he was taken aback, of course. No one wants to be called a vulture by your colleagues at a conference. However, however, he began to embrace that description later on when he thought about it. Yes, we are like scavengers. We will use what we have when we can to make a connection with another human being. Someone said to me, "You know, chaplain, I don't read the Bible." I said, "Well, what's your sacred text?" He says, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, I like this, I like that." I said, "Tupac, Biggie, who?" You know, so we did a whole textual analysis, textual criticism to Tupac Shakur's lyrics and Biggie Smalls' lyrics to find their sacred text. We show up and go where we have to go. We show up. I show up in the room of the Obama-hating, camo-wearing, Fox News-watching family with love. And every time I'm surprised, and every time they are too. That is in the moment. That's where we show up. So, like any radical effort, we do not always set out to be radical. We do not always set out to change the status quo. We do not always want to do that either. It can be stressful. We don't always want to upset the apple cart, but sometimes we do. Sometimes we challenge a person's selfhood or a community's identity, but by the way we do it is by posing those special questions, the right pauses, that furtive look, reaching out to a tear or a shout of anger can create a moment of radical engagement that unearths new landscapes, new paths for an individual or a family or a community in crisis. I remember, and I'm going to stop here, a woman who lost her baby, largely because of policy. Healthcare policy in the community was not serving her well, and her baby died when it was born shortly thereafter. Now, I've seen lots and lots of dead babies, dead children, dead people. But this particular moment, as she cried, she says, "I don't know what I'm supposed to do now, but I know I'm supposed to say something about God. I'm supposed to do something." She says, "What do we do?" And I did not speak. I simply took the profuse tears that were coming off this young woman's face and collected them into the tissue and held them in my hand and baptized the baby with the tears of her love. That's showing up. Thank you.
Whoa. Those of us who are chaplains come to this call from many different, sometimes strange and various directions and places. Are there any chaplains in the house?
All right.
There are. And are there others who have known, cared about, interested in, know someone who is, or maybe just curious about chaplains? Okay, and them too, and some of us are both of those. I served full-time in our Unitarian Universalist ministry as a congregational minister for 18 years. Then I served part-time while my daughters were being teenagers and did other work. And then after that storm and flood that we had back here in New Orleans, I live in New Orleans, 11 years ago, I moved into chaplaincy. Went back, did 4 units of CPE. Anybody done CPE? Woo! CP Supervisor. For those of you who don't know, CPE means Clinical Pastoral Education. Bona fide CPE units are through the ACPE, and you have to have 4 of those units to become a board-certified chaplain. And it's an incredibly intense experience to do 1 unit of CPE, let alone 4. 300 contact patient hours, 100 hours of supervision and group work, and bearing your soul and being called to be totally honest and vulnerable every waking moment. And it is a heart-wrenching process, and I don't know anyone who's gotten through it well who didn't go into therapy while they were doing it. Maybe some of y'all did. I want to know who you were later, how you did it, because not me. I serve full-time a hospital here in New Orleans. I am the full-time board-certified chaplain manager. I am the only full-time man. I'm the only paid chaplain of a hospital of about 300 beds. Yeah. We do have a part-time priest, so I don't have to call a priest. And I have developed a cadre of incredible pastoral care volunteers over the years who I supervise very closely. But I'm it. And I get to be a Unitarian Universalist chaplain. I am paid by Southern Baptist money to serve in a Jewish hospital that is predominantly Catholic patients. Thank you. This is chaplaincy in New Orleans. We have an extremely diverse population of staff and patients and families, ranging from those who continue to reel economically, spiritually, socially from the effects of generations of racism in this city and in this country, to those who have experienced all the blessings that white privilege can possibly bestow in this city and in this country. And we have a huge Vietnamese population. We have a number of Hispanic people who've moved into the city in the last number of years, and many from the Indian subcontinent. This is a port city, and we have a lot of tourists. If you break your ankle, you will probably end up at my hospital, and I will be your chaplain. Watch those streetcar tracks. We get about 1 a week from the streetcar tracks. I consider myself in this setting a radical chaplain. First, I want to confide something in you that really Karen and I didn't talk about what she just said. Okay, it's radical chaplaincy, do it. And we came up with some of the same root ideas here. I believe real chaplaincy is, at its heart, radical. At least that's what I've come to understand in my over 10 years. 11. And 11 units of CPE. Yet, Karen has added the adjective radical to our discussion. So let's take it even further. Chaplains at our core, as she has so beautifully described, walk alongside a person, accompanying them in deep ways as they experience, usually, suffering, and attempt to find some meaning, attempt to help them articulate out of their own experience some meaning in that suffering. Yet radical chaplaincy goes a step further. I think that chaplaincy becomes radical if it changes things, if it alters reality, if by being chaplains in a given setting, reality shifts in a new way for the person that we are walking alongside or rolling alongside. We become agents to help people to shift their reality so that they begin to see life, experience life and imagine life in new ways, perhaps with more hope, more recognition of love around them, a new perspective of possibilities. Now, most chaplains have a set of tools of the trade. We learn active listening. We learn the stages of grief. We learn about boundaries and multiculturalism and the practices of various faith traditions. Yes, we are vultures. We learn body language skills. And all of these are part of our toolbox of things as we walk alongside a suffering, struggling, questing, or wondering person. Yet in radical chaplaincy, we go further. We don't forget these skills, but we also take a huge leap into the unknown. The only way to be an agent of transformation, to help people to shift their reality, to see a new way of being, is to get in the boat with them and go wherever they need to go. And the only tool we really have to offer is ourselves, our whole being, everything that we are, everything we know, everything we believe. This is the gift that we offer another on this journey. And we hope that they may be able to find in this gift something that they can use to experience a transformation in their suffering. It's sort of like, have any of y'all gone up to the, yeah, I can say y'all, I'm from here. And I say it authentically. Did any of y'all go up to the Riverwalk food court yet? There are these wonderful, huge floor-to-ceiling windows. Well, I was up there this past Tuesday during ministry day when the rain was at its most intense. I was eating at the food court and looking out over the river, and the rain was coming down in buckets and buckets and buckets, and it was obscuring everything out on the river. As I tried to look over to the land on the other bank of the river, and it's a mile away, it was mostly obscured by the grayness and fogginess of the pouring rain. Any boats out there on the river really couldn't see where they were going. It's like that when we get into the boat with someone as their radical chaplain. They may be taking us nowhere that we know. Nothing looks familiar. No landmarks. We are just along for the ride. One morning not long ago at the hospital that I serve, I began my chaplaincy visits for the day by going up to see patients on our head injury rehab unit. When I was out in the hallway, I met Matt. I'll call him Matt. You know, patient confidentiality. His name is Matt, as far as you know, and he was strapped into a wheelchair. I introduced myself, and he greeted me with his eyes and a clumsy nod of his head. I asked permission to pull up a chair to be near him and offered a few words. He clearly was nonverbal. I acknowledged his struggles and his challenges in the days ahead. I thanked him for the privilege of being with him as he works to get stronger. Eventually, I asked if he would like to have prayer together, and Matt nodded yes. He lifted his hand slightly. Around here, people pray by holding hands, unless they're Episcopals. Some of my best friends are Episcopals. Matt lifted his hand, and I took it in mine. I closed my eyes, but I sensed that he was watching me. I paused, and I breathed, and then I prayed. I prayed for the presence of holiness here. I prayed that Matt feels eternal love with him, in good times and in bad, in sickness and in health. I prayed for a blessing of healing in body and in spirit. Does prayer work? Who knows? Chaplaincy has turned a lot of us good humanist Unitarian Universalists into real praying people. You know, some scientific double blind studies seem to indicate that prayer somehow sometimes makes a difference. I certainly do not believe that prayer sparks an intervention by a conscious God who, on a whim, and because I asked, is actually going to change his mind about who should be sick and who shouldn't. But is prayer a focusing of energy from out there in the cosmos? Is it a deep welling up of healing power from within the person who knows he or she is being prayed for? Is it Henry Nelson Wyman's creative event that occurs when Matt and I pray? Is it an experience of Martin Buber's I-thou relationship? Is it all of these things or something more altogether? I don't know, but this I do know. When I finish the prayer with Matt and I open my eyes, he is looking at me. He is gripping my hand. And when our eyes meet, he breathes a deep sigh and nods, yes. As a radical chaplain, I hope that when I go into a patient's room or sit with them in the hallway, I do more than simply visit the sick. I go hoping to offer a relationship of I-thou, a relationship which I hope may be helpful for their physical or spiritual healing. I can offer that relationship. I can get in the boat with them only if I am willing to let go of whatever expectations I have of the situation and let them guide me where they need to go. That letting go piece, that's often hard, especially since in my own theology, I often feel like I'm on the rainy boat, on the rainy river, with no shore in sight. You see, when I go home in the evening and I look up at the stars, yeah, I can see the stars from my backyard about 3 miles from here upriver. I look up at the stars and I become aware once again that we live at the intersection of two infinities. A walk on a clear moonless night reveals a universe of billions of stars, a universe which we are told is endlessly expanding, as if our galaxies are dots on a balloon, which is being blown out and out and out. There is no end, no limit to its expansion, we're told. I can't imagine it. It's infinite space, infinite time, infinity. On the other hand, molecular physicists confront us with yet another startling assertion, the infinity of the small. You can observe this infinity any moment you choose. Look at your hand. There before you are cells, molecules, atoms, protons, neutrons, and electrons, and stuff that's been discovered since I was in high school. With names like quarks and Higgs bosons. Yeah, you've read the paper. Since high school, they've learned a lot. Until finally, it's all the same stuff, which is, in essence, particles of energy. Not only that, but we will never fully observe these particles. It's called the uncertainty principle. If we cannot accurately observe the position of a particle, we cannot know its energy or impulse at the same time. We can't know all of what it is. A hospital, good metaphor, Jane. A hospital is also a world of both and, where two seemingly different realities, more than one, many different realities, can exist at the same time. It is a place of hope and fear. It is a place of death and life. It is a place where boundaries overlap and touch and co-create and merge and meld and fall apart again. Seeming miracles in the cardiology lab. Unexpected death in the labor and delivery suite. It's a place where nothing is sure and everything matters. When I first walked into a Unitarian Universalist church 40 years ago, I did so having rejected the loving yet manipulative Father God of my childhood. I could no longer fit what I was learning in high school and college about the infinities of space and the infinities of molecular biology. I couldn't fit those infinities into the tight theological pigeonholes of my mainline Protestant upbringing. However, I still had the sense that beyond all definitions and doctrines, something infinite and good existed in which I participated. What was it? Could I even begin to understand or name it? As a chaplain today, my questions continue to evolve. How can I speak of an ultimately indefinable God by any other name, with patients and families? How can I use language to describe that which is indescribable? And with all of my own questions, how can I be someone else's radical chaplain, one who will be a resource and an agent of transformation, with others who may be desperately trying to find answers to their own ultimate questions about the meaning of their lives in a world of no certain answers? We are living, you and I, and some of us are doing chaplaincy in this world. I am here to listen to, walk with, hold hands with, cry and laugh and pray with those who are living the excruciating joy and sorrow that exists on the boundary, on the intersection with death and life. So often there is nothing to say. So often the job, the challenge, is to simply show up, to be a witness, to be present, to get in the leaky, storm-tossed boat and be a companion on the stormy river that appears to have no boundaries and no safe shore. Sometimes it feels like, you remember the first Star Wars movie and Luke Skywalker had flown off to find Jedi Master Yoda and he crashes on a strange planet in a deep swamp? And the mists and the strange sounds and the muckiness of the swamp feel like they are going to swallow him. You remember that image? It was really scary to me. Somewhere in this swamp is the great Jedi Master that he is seeking. But he can't seem to find the meaning that he is seeking in this wet, dark, tangled world. It feels like an impossible task. That's chaplaincy some days. Nothing is real. And something meaningful is happening. We just don't know where it is or what it is or our part in it. Recently, I was called to our labor and delivery unit to be with a young couple who were facing an agonizing decision. They were a young Catholic couple who were clearly deeply devoted to each other. Maria was maybe 16, 18 weeks along in her pregnancy, and she and Carlos had been joyfully planning to welcome a second child. Their first, a little two-year-old boy, was at home with grandma that day. However, Maria's water had broken. If she continued the pregnancy, she was told, she would surely develop a terrible infection that would threaten her life. There was also no way that she would be able to continue the pregnancy long enough for the baby to survive once it was born. Did I mention they were Catholic? I knocked on the door of their room. I walked in. I introduced myself. "Chaplain," Carlos said, "we just don't know what to do. Our faith tells us that to end this pregnancy is a sin. Yet if we don't end it, Maria could, he looked at his beloved with tears on his eyes. He couldn't even finish his sentence. Maria was quietly crying. "I love this baby," she said. "We love God. We want to do the right thing. We just don't know what to do." So the nurses had called the chaplain. I took a deep breath. There was so much love in this room. There was no sure answer. Yet there was such love. And so that was what I could offer them. Theirs was a boat of pain and love. "Maria, Carlos," I said, "I see how much you love each other. You love your son at home. You love God. My faith also tells me that God is love." They nodded in agreement. I took another deep breath. "I believe that whatever decision you make in love will be the right decision. Love for this baby now and always. Love for your son. Love for each other. Love for God. Whatever you decide to do, if you decide in love, it will be the right decision." Don't you love it when you say the right thing sometimes? You save those moments for sermon illustrations or presentation illustrations. So there was quiet in the room. Carlos and Maria looked at each other. Then they looked back at me. After a long moment, they looked back at me. And Carlos said, "I think we know what we need to do, what we want to do. I think we'll call the doctors and tell them to go ahead and do it." Maria nodded. "Can we pray?" asked Maria. Like, maybe she could never pray again. So we held hands and I prayed. "O thou creator, sustainer, thou spirit of all love, we are so grateful for this family. We are grateful for Carlos and Maria, for their son, and for this babe. We trust, O Holy One, that you love us. For however many days and years we have upon this earth, and you love us on into eternity. Please be with Maria and Carlos and help them to trust that you and your love will guide and sustain them and will sustain the soul of this baby, who, when this soul flies on home to you, will surely rest in you forever. Please guide and comfort these parents. May your love be their strength and help. In the name of thy Son, Jesus, we pray. And then together in their tradition, we said in our Father and a Hail Mary. I've learned a Hail Mary. It goes real great with my goddess theology. If I had gone into my head with Maria and Carlos, I might have argued for terminating the pregnancy for medical or family reasons. They, however, needed to make the decision out of their own faith. I had to jump into that Catholic boat with them. It's not one I grew up with, but it's their boat. And trust that with me along, they would row their boat where they needed to go. In radical chaplaincy, we need to get out of our heads. This doesn't mean just blurting out the first thing that comes to mind, like brainstorming. It means doing deep theology. Every moment we are with someone, I don't think that we can do radical, transformative chaplaincy without also doing deep theology. We need awareness of what we believe and, like Karen said so well, a curiosity about how that theology is shaping everything that we do. When we are on the boundary land, when we are out on the stormy and endless river, feeling like we are being swept into the vast ocean, having a sense of what we believe right now can be the clear, will be the clear center that holds us. One late morning, I was paged to come quickly to provide pastoral support to a family whose loved one, Mr. Jonas, was dying in our intensive care unit after years of illness. Several of the patient's brothers and friends stood vigil, praying around his bed. More family arrived, including a deacon from their small rural Louisiana church. Eventually, the deacon moved to the head of the patient's bed and started singing. Now, our ICU rooms are really small. And everything that's happening in the small room, the glass doors, they're open. Everybody's hearing everything. And all the unit is hearing the singing that is low and powerful, prayer and song. Two brothers joined in, carrying harmony. They sang songs that I do not know, but some phrases were familiar. If you get there before I do, and he's coming home. The normal hubbub of the busy ICU quieted. The glass door to Mr. Jonas's room was open, with only a curtain separating us from the other people in the unit. The power of the music reached out to many others, nurses, doctors, other patients. I stood with the family around the bed, the only pale person in the room, and yet feeling brought in, welcomed, as I was in that boat with them that moment. We were swaying and humming, praying in song. I felt that I was moving between two worlds, the world of faith and the world of the hospital medical routine. We are the ones who get to do that. I also felt fully, authentically present in both worlds. Mr. Jonas's family embraced me and asked me to lead a prayer. That was so cool. The hospital personnel seemed to relax, able to step out of the room, get out of the way, and trust that what was happening there, because I was with them. As Mr. Jonas took his last breaths, I asked the deacon to lead us in singing again, to sing him on home. There was truly eternal peace in that room, and we all knew it. Everyone around that bedside, everyone in the ICU, knew that something very special and holy was happening there. There was nothing I had to teach, nothing I had to do. My job as their chaplain was to show up, to be present, to be with them on the boundary between sacred and secular, literally between life and death, to help create a setting of safety and trust so that the family could pray and the hospital staff could do their work of helping Mr. Jonas to die pain-free. The I-thou relationships between the family members, the deacon, other staff, and me were relationships that dissolved boundaries as we stepped into a strange land beyond usual definitions and descriptions. No, we did not stop each being who we were. Yet in that event, I believe we all experienced something more than our individual selves. That is so freaking cool when that happens. Excuse my language. My mother taught me better. As radical chaplains, we live in the murky swamp, trusting that there is meaning somewhere, but often trying to use our logical minds that only obscure the safe shore. We step into the boat, whether that boat is a room in an ICU, a labor and delivery room, a rehab hallway, the streets of Chicago, the prisons of Illinois, the streets of New Orleans where we have NOPD chaplains, the hospices, the social settings, wherever we serve. We step into the boat, hoping that our presence and ourselves will be instruments of transformation that the other persons might be able to use to steer themselves safely to shore. The gift that we offer in the ICU room, wherever we are, the gift is ourselves, just who we are, that moment. And the gift includes completely trusting, honoring, and respecting the other person, wherever they are, whatever they believe. It is truly radical stuff, my dear friends. And it's an adventure. And it's a privilege. We get to put our Unitarian Universalist faith into practice every day. We get to be radical agents of transformative love. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you, Jane. I want to ask now that we just have a time for chatting and talking and questioning and sharing. We've got a bunch of chaplains in here, so let's just open it up to whatever people want to talk about.
And I'd ask if you, I'm not all that good in hearing in this space. If you have something to say, ask, how about standing and being Olympia Brown and belting it out?
I was going to do the Oprah thing and walk around, but it's all taped down, so sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
There's
another mic. Oh. Oh, yeah.
How far?
Oh, yeah, it's good. Okay.
I can be your mic carrying person.
It goes this far.
Oh, perfect. Just pass it around and then turn around and talk to everybody.
Hi. So my name is Joanna Lubkin. I'm a chaplain at Wellesley College outside of Boston. And I want to thank you both for sharing. And one of the things that came up in both of your stories is the idea of both transformational encounters and getting in the boat with where somebody is. And what I wonder is, from your experiences as Unitarian Universalists, Where do you go when you encounter theology that seems to be harmful, that that this is God's will, that I'm being punished, that I'm not enough, that God has this plan for me, like things that to join them on not only is just like not your theology, but feels like it could be harmful. So I'm curious how you do both.
Jane, you just start there. Okay, I can start a little bit about that. First of all, as Jane was saying about the boat, if we're truly going to be in that boat, we have to go in the boat with theologies that we find disturbing. And oftentimes, one of the things that we can do is to give people permission to explore their own theology. That's something they don't get to do very much. They'll give you the platitude, Lord won't give me more than I can handle. They'll give you all of that. But if you ask that next right question, tell me about your relationship with God. Tell me how God talks to you. Tell me about, just asking and engaging more about their relationship with this theology usually opens some things up. And often, and I've been in certain situations in my own African-American community, I've been like big mama to some people too, because that might be who they see me as. Okay, so I will take on a certain questioning mode or a certain engagement mode that is familiar to them at that time. And that can also give them permission to ask questions of that particular figure in their family that they've never been able to ask questions to. So we are chameleons in enough ways that we're able to morph sometimes into the person or the priest or the pastor that they've never been able to talk to. I mean, we work in medical settings where pastors generally aren't showing up. Okay, I'm in Minnesota, you're in New Orleans, other end of the Mississippi, but still, we don't always have pastors that show up. So we're it. We're it for like 80% of the people. And because of that, we have to be it and be willing to take the brunt, take the heat, take the questions that people wouldn't normally be able to do with their pastors.
Can I say one thing about that as well? While we need to be in that boat with that person, when you're faced with that dangerous theology outside of that situation from someone who is into that situation and is preaching or advocating for a position that is dangerous maybe to that situation, you as a chaplain have that responsibility to address that with that person. Mm-hmm. When I'm a chaplain in a small rural community, very fundamentalist community, and we have ministers that would come in situations that just have to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot go into the or have the pastor coming into the intensive care unit and try to get the patient out of the bed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's the way you pray.
Right.
Oh,
absolutely. Anything that causes harm, particularly there in the medical setting, you have to address. And I've done that a million times, too. I'm sure Jane has as well.
I deal with that question almost every day, and it drives our medical staff crazy. When a person on every machine that can possibly be plugged into or onto a person, the family says, it's God's will, God will take him or her when it's time. And God clearly is calling this person and has been calling a long time, and we won't let him or her go to use their theology into the situation. It's very hard when family are using their theology as a way of denying death. And my first, it takes a while of developing a relationship of trust. Mm-hmm. They're not going to talk to me until they've gotten to know me. And if and I'm speaking mostly about end-of-life situations or extending life situations with what I call bad theology, my job is not to change their theology, but to get in the boat with them, to accompany them, so that as our conversation evolves,
I can lift up some questions like, I wonder if sometimes we get in the way when God is calling Mama home. I wonder if medicine sometimes is a gift and sometimes we forget to let God be God. I can't say that 10 minutes into meeting a family. But I can lift up the questions once they've grown to trust me.
Okay, go ahead, right here, Hugh. On Facebook?
Did you all hear that? Search on Facebook for UU Chaplains.
Who's managing it? Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's right.
Other questions?
Over here. Yeah.
Come on up to the mic, folks.
Yeah. Yeah, just come on up and talk.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm Kai. I am a palliative care chaplain in Austin, Texas. And yeah, at a Catholic hospital. And I guess one thing that, I've been thinking about a lot is when folks have put God up as sort of a wall, like to wall out medical staff sometimes, or to wall out really hard conversations or complexities that, you know, that there's just not a lot of preparation for. I mean, in my family life, there certainly isn't, you know, and then to be called to deal with a complex situation and words you don't know, and, you know, it's just really hard. Mm-hmm. And I guess one thing that I've been trying to work with is opening that wondering space for, you know, what if God is a bridge right now? What if God is the bridge and not the wall?
What if God is the thing
that is walking with us no matter what's going to happen, and we don't get to tell God what's going to happen. You know, so anyhow, I really appreciate this conversation because I've been thinking about this
a lot. Great.
Great.
Who else next? Yeah, there you go.
Yes. Real-time technology update. So there are probably a number of groups, but the one I was referencing is relatively new. It is just called UU Chaplains, and it is a closed group, which means you can ask to join and somebody will approve it. The criteria for this particular group, and maybe there's more that could go, is a group for UU ministers serving as chaplains to connect, open to all UU Ministers Association members who are post-CPE and working as chaplains.
Cool.
So that exists. Maybe there's more.
When did that start?
Like a couple months ago.
Great.
Yep.
Good.
This is exactly
what I wanted to see happen with people getting together, forming groups.
Good.
Hello, my name is Jen. I'm a chaplain at a hospital in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm also a CPE supervisory candidate.
Sorry.
So, absolutely. I was really intrigued, Karen, by your mentioning of the situation of the protest and the two sides, particularly, I find myself more and more going to more protests, being out there, wondering how I can bring my chaplaincy self more and more to those situations. And I'm thinking both for folks who feel as I do, how to be a chaplain to them, but then, my goodness, how to even be a chaplain across those boundaries?
Mm-hmm.
I want to hear more about that.
Yeah, I think there is actually a small pamphlet that someone sent me not too long ago about how to do chaplaincy at protests. And you can find me, and I'll get that to you. It's 4 or 5 pages, but it's really very good little tips. I've also been in situations, I've been in a lot of protests because, you know, that's what we do these days. But I've also worn a sign that says, if you need to talk, just like wear it. I do things with my CPE students to teach them how to do that by taking them to this big food court in Minneapolis. I did it in Chicago, too. And we set up signs at lunchtime as chaplain, what gives your life meaning and purpose, do you pray? I have them spread out all throughout the food cart with these little things on tables while they're eating their lunch. And interestingly enough, people come up and talk to us. quite a bit. And it teaches the CPE students that are learning to be chaplains how to do that stuff on the fly. But also, we've had those kinds of debates, often in public settings. But I think if you just make yourself known that you're there, just like we have chaplains here at GA, they make it known that there is a place. Also, our presence can kind of quell some, you know, stuff from getting out of control sometimes. And just by wearing a collar or wearing a stole, if you're a minister, showing up in that garb sometimes is a signal. It can deter some people, it can attract people, it make people repel at the same time, but it is a symbol. If you have that plus, you know, the appropriate buttons, you know, it kind of works. You mix and match. But with the anarchists and the Christians, they're about ready to fight, really. This got really out of control. And I'm more of a trauma chaplain. That's my attraction, trauma. And so I get right in the middle of it, and I said, you know, we started talking about, what is it that you're trying to do? What is it you're trying to do? Just trying to be a mediator a little bit, too. And then I talked to the Christians about their faith and what it really requires of them. And I talked to the anarchists about, you know, the anarchist cookbook. I mean, because I've read that. So, you know, you have to be able to speak a lot of languages in those situations. So, somebody else? Yeah. Mine?
Yeah,
it's the stuff, that's ministerial authority. I mean, I've been a minister 25 years, and I just show up, and I have it. And for these folks, I mean, I exert it. I carry myself in that kind of way. I've been a part of many of these communities for a while, and but it just shows up. I mean, I was out last night. And, you know, a little fight took place. I just walked right into that, too. You know, so, you know, really, it's just something that I do. And it's because of who I am, and it's because of the call to show up. I just keep showing up. And when you keep showing up, you develop a certain amount of authority, I think.
Other questions? Comments?
Yeah.
Thoughts? Reflections?
Yeah.
Wisdom?
Hi, I'm Christina. I'm a chaplain, a palliative care chaplain in Los Angeles. And I really would like to have a conversation among you chaplains and hear from you about what working as a chaplain has done for your theology and how you've noticed that changing. Especially, I think, as a chaplain, knowing how to kind of speak many different languages of faith. Like when I did CPE, I never thought that I would learn how to pray to God out loud with other people.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, after years and years of doing that, uh-huh. sometimes I feel like very different from other UU colleagues or lay people. And so I've been really thinking about what it does for our theology and also what it does for the conversation we're having right now about anti-racism and, you know, being in so many situations with people who are maybe different in terms of cultural background, theological background, so many differences as a chaplain, and coming in and seeing them as family and getting to know them and really having that authentic relationship. Like, how are these experiences we're having as chaplains helping what we can help lead, lend to our denomination in the future?
That's a good one.
Sorry. Long
Go
question.
Ahead. That's a good question.
I bet we all have some answers to that.
Yeah,
I'd be interested in hearing several of yours. I think Unitarian Universalists are uniquely, extremely well qualified to be chaplains because we have flexible theologies. We have theologies that bend and grow and stretch and are open to new insight from whencever it shines or comes, whatever the quote is, clearly. And so mine is always evolving.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of good
yes.
essays that are theologically rooted in this book
mm-hmm.
written by different Unitarian Universalist chaplains, some of whom discuss how their theology changed over their chaplaincy.
Yep.
So some of my chaplain colleagues, I'm part of a group of 12 here in New Orleans that meet monthly,
are very, very deeply rooted in their faith, and that faith is much more fixed and defined and unchanging. No, there's subtleties and there are changes. Mine is much more, not amorphous, but able to be in, able to stretch and grow. And what is it? We're all open to light.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that partly answers your question. I'm curious what others have to say.
Yeah, I'll just say briefly, for me, I'm a straight-up humanist in the style of more of an African-American humanist. I'm going to preface that because it's not necessarily a secular humanist. But I'm a cultural Christian to do my job, okay? I'm a cultural Christian. So I define myself as a straight-up black humanist. I always say that because there's a lot of different. And we have organizations, too, African-American humanists, you know. But anyway, and that's how I do it. Other people? Yeah. What do you think?
When you go into the hospital room, it's not about your theology. It's about, you know, you bring God into the
theology.
That's how I look at it.
And how they see you.
In their language, whatever they need.
Where do you do chaplains?
St. Luke's Hospital.
All right. St. Luke's, yeah. They were looking for CP supervisors for a while. I'm from Pennsylvania. That's that's all right. That's a bad joke.
I've done 4 units of CPE and have been employed as a hospice chaplain since February. But like somebody else mentioned, it was very awkward for me at the beginning, my first unit, being asked to pray with people. I was so intimidated, and my supervisor would force me to role play it.
Yeah, that's what I do.
And then over the months, I just grew to love it. I really loved, I still love that part of my job, but and I have lots of favorite prayers, but my very favorite prayer was a young atheist mom at the hospital whose life was, there were so many things. She was trying to maintain her sobriety. She was in recovery, a kid in the hospital, all kinds of family issues. And early in our conversation, she had told me that she was an atheist. And then much later, I was with her like an hour and a half. And she said, as I was about to leave, she said, "I really feel like I want to ask you to pray, but I'm an atheist." She repeated that she was an atheist. And she kind of like laughed and kind of shrugged it off. And I said, "Well, wait a minute, let's talk about that a minute." And I said, "In your head, do you find yourself talking to somebody in particular, maybe a favorite relative or somebody that had been close to you when you were a child?" And she said, "Yeah, I was always close to my grandfather, my pop-pop, and I talked to him in my head." I said, "Well, let's pray to pop-pop." And so we gathered around her child, around the bed, and prayed to pop-pop. It's still, of all my prayers with patients, that's still my favorite one.
That's lovely. Yeah, other thoughts about that? That's a very, very important question you raised there about theology. One thing I did with my students last year, I'm always trying to think of something to outdo myself and make it more fun. But I used all these YouTube videos of people talking about dying of cancer because I started a new pilot CPE program in an outpatient oncology clinic in Minnesota. And so it's just all about cancer every day. And these were all videos that people make randomly on YouTube about as they're dying. You know, you can just Google people dying, and people will come on, and they'll just be telling you their last story or whatever. And so I showed these little clips to my students. And but prior to that time, we did a thing called elevator theology. We took the elevator in the hospital, and I said, "Okay, by the time we get to the top floor, you've got to describe your theology. It doesn't matter who's in the elevator." So as a group, we get in this big elevator, and they have to like start like on the basement, and then by the time we get to 8, and people stop and get on, and they have just that amount of time to do it. But I said, "Write it down, the major constructs of your theology." And as we're watching the videos, is there anything you have to offer them? This is just a practice thing. Take a slip of paper and put it on the table in front of them while they're talking. And some people just had all these things when the language was familiar. And then people didn't have anything to offer when it was. And it was really not to practice offering people things, but practice thinking about how limited we are and how we have to be able to listen to that person more than offering our own stuff. That was sort of the point of the game. So there's a lot of ways we can practice it, too.
So I volunteer as a chaplain at the Juvenile Detention Center in downtown Seattle, which is it's a great ministry, but oh my gosh. We ran into an issue where some of the chaplains were trying to convert youth who were incarcerated. And it ended up being that for myself, I was the only one they would talk to because they knew I wasn't Christian. And I had to really learn about Islamic theology because we had a number of youth who were there who were Muslim and a number of youth who were indigenous. And I found conversations about their traditions worked in that chaplain healing process. Mm-hmm. But I find that as a Unitarian Universalist, I have access in places that other people won't. Yep. And I find that's a powerful, powerful piece of my faith.
Yep, great. It's so true. Other folks? Yeah.
I was wondering how you experience praying with someone, and maybe if they've shared experience of praying with you in an authentic way when both parties know that your theologies aren't the same, and how that changes the way they experience praying and how you experience praying as well, knowing that it's not about your theology, it's about their theology. You're still experiencing this prayerful moment and trying to make it as authentic as possible for both parties, presumably.
They don't usually know my theology.
That's right.
They have no idea what my theology is. All it says is chaplain, and that usually takes them wherever they need me to be.
Exactly.
For the Christians, I'm Christian. For the Catholics, I'm Catholic. For the Jews, it's like, oh, whatever. There's only one God. Mostly Reformed Jews are the ones.
Right.
The Muslim folk have been very welcoming. I mean, they assume I'm not Muslim, and the Jewish community is small enough, they pretty much know I'm not Jewish, except I married a Jewish man. I go back through Temple Sinai, 5 generations through him, so I'm okay. But people don't know my theology.
That's right.
I listen to them, and I hear where they are, and I invite, I try to open myself with curiosity about where they are, mm-hmm. and that will lead me into an understanding of what their theology is, usually.
Exactly. One thing I just want to say about that, too, is that our listening skills help us be able also to pick up on cues about what their theology is. For instance, if I walk in a room, everybody's talking about the Holy Spirit. Okay, then we're moving to some Pentecostal area. So then I'll say, well, you know, if they want to read something from the Bible, I say, well, let's go to Luke, because Luke, you know, mentions the Holy Spirit more than any other text in the Bible. So there, bam, you know, we're connecting. Okay, so you've got to be literate in a lot of different places in order to be able to do this work. What time is it?
We're kind of out of time.
Oh,
Is there any more pressing questions?
Yeah, this was fun.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right.
We will be up here to talk if you want to continue the conversation.
I'm fine. You're a great preacher, girl. You are.
Good. I'm coming.